This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
You're with ABC Radio National. I'm Claudia Taranto. The Stuart Highway stretches north for 1,500 kilometres from Alice Springs to Darwin. It was the vital artery through which the lifeblood of supplies and personnel poured northwards to defend Australia in World War II. Now, on hindsight, Mike Sweet uses the extensive collection of interviews from the Northern Territory Archive to tell the story of this unique outback highway and the men and women who witnessed war at home. Here's The Road to War.
The Stuart Highway, which traverses two climatic regions and pushes up from the central desert to the tropics, is an Australian road like no other. I've lived in Darwin just off the highway for the past few years and become fascinated by this road and its history. For many years, the highway was little more than a narrow dirt track beside the overland telegraph line. Known as the North-South Road, it followed the route taken by the explorer John McDowell Stuart, who crossed the continent in 1862. Nearly 150 years later, echoes and relics of the past remain. Most vividly, the highway's role in the Second World War. Few people still realise the scale of the war in Australia's north. That Japanese air raids took place for 2 years on Darwin and the Top End, and that the attacks reached as far south as Katherine, over 300 kilometres down the highway. Between 1941 and 1945, convoys carried servicemen and women up the road in their hundreds of thousands to Australia's front line. Aircraft from roadside airstrips intercepted enemy planes and launched bombing missions deep into Japanese-held territory. Wounded were cared for in field hospitals along the route. Beside the highway, the fallen were laid to rest. My journey and this story begins where the convoys began their journey, in Alice Springs. In 1940, the Alice was a community of less than 1,000 people, mostly dependent on the outlying pastoral industry. In September that year, the Darwin Overland Maintenance Force set up camp below Anzac Hill, and it would provide the convoys to supply Darwin as war came ever closer. American journalist Edgar Lather travelled with the Overland Maintenance Force.
The Darwin Overland Maintenance Force cuts the heart of Australia open like a pair of scissors. For hours, infinity to right, infinity to left, infinity behind us, infinity before us, the motor roaring in our ears. For hours, the strong reflections of the sun have tired our eyes. The boys on the convoy are overwhelmed by the vastness of their country. The nearing tropical north goes through them, impregnates, frightens, exalts, inspires them.
Charles Rye was a civilian in Alice Springs and remembers life alongside the service personnel.
Actually, in this town, despite the fact that it was 1,000 miles from anywhere, you might say, we had a blackout. No street lights, no lights at the windows, all blinds drawn and what have you. And you went outside and it was total darkness apart from any moonlight. But on one evening, I was staying at the Stuart Arms and I could hear a drum beating. So we were playing cards in one of the lounges inside. We went out and there was a parade of soldiers beating a drum and shouting, "We want leave, we want leave." And they were throwing stones on the roofs and on the windows, and it was a near riot. Of course, the whole camp was closed the next day. Everybody confined to barracks. And eventually Brigadier Lauder had a big assembly on the Antarctic Oval and told the troops that he appreciated their worries about not getting any leave at all, but he said that probably told them there was other guys overseas fighting for their lives. Troops were coming and going all the time, but there was a sort of a base team of mechanics and administrative staff, stores people. And then there was two picture theatres here, plus the Army Theatre. And you could see a different show every night of the week, including Sundays. And the Army Theatre was at the back of Anzac Hill. And when the lights had gone out and the movie started, some of us civvies used to sneak up and sit on the rocks up there and watch the movies. And the benches were made out of mulga posts and bits of 3x2. But down near the front where the screen was, there was a big rows of steamer chairs for the nurses and the officers to sit down there.
Alan Smith was a convoy officer based in Alice.
You can imagine that those vehicles travelling on this road, what condition it was in. It was either dusty, corrugated, or when it was wet, was muddy and in a shocking state. Apart from troops, there'd be food, ammunition, equipment, drums of fuel. It was a vital part of the Australian war effort.
In a letter home in August 1942, a young soldier from New South Wales reflected on his arrival in the Red Centre and the road he then travelled.
It seemed grim in the extreme to be sent here just after returning from the Middle East. From 16 degrees below zero, the forests and soft snows of the Lebanon, to the heat and discomfort of the Great Dead Heart. The sooner this Great Dead Heart business is forgotten, the better. Rolling miles of green grass, of low hills, of small dried creek beds and occasional pools, of kangaroos and scrub turkeys and squawking black cockatoos. The fertile, pulsating bowl that is Alice Springs. That masterpiece of engineering, the north-south road to Darwin, gangs of Australians and Americans with giant levellers and bulldozers tearing an ordered highway out of the tangled, mysterious wilds of the north. The roaring convoys, their tyres beating a rhythm of energy on the dirt roads. Trucks by the hundred, driven by Australians and Americans, making for the north, with the stores which are to be the lifeblood of the northern defenders.
Wish me luck as you wave me goodbye. Cheerio, here I go on my way. Wish me luck as you wave me goodbye. With a cheer, not a tear, make it gay.
From Red River Gums, through the Mulga lands to the rolling Spinifex grasslands surrounding Tennant Creek, the Stuart Highway crosses the Tropic of Capricorn, and then heads up, on through the central desert. Letty Cudahy was a nurse on her way to Adelaide River in April 1943. Letty recalls her journey alongside the troops.
It was a very large convoy. There were a lot of Air Force guys, and there were AMWAs and sisters on it, and they were trucks, and we had just wooden seats along each side. And we staged at the various staging camps along the way. And I think we were the first women that staged at these camps. The journey was great. It was hard and it was tiring. And when we got to the staging camps, it was usually in a big hut with a camp stretcher and a palliasse, we called them, which was a hessian bag filled with straw, more or less. And they fed us as reasonably as we could. And then we'd take off very early in the morning for the next one.
Harry Krantz was with the 6th Army Group, one of the thousands of soldiers who made the journey.
You left the bitumen just shortly after Alice Springs. The trucks had a limit, 20 miles an hour. The trucks stopped. The old army rule of 10 minutes every 2 hours. It was a very, very hot and terribly dusty. The first night was at Barrack Creek, the second night at Banker. You got a shower at these places. Water was scarce. It was hot. You'd go in for the meal, it'd be 8 o'clock at night. Meat and a big spud in its jacket and probably cabbage.
Following the first attacks on Darwin in 1942, a convoy travelled daily from Queensland along what was to become the Barclay Highway, which connects with the Stuart Highway at the Three Ways Junction. These convoys brought supplies from Mount Isa across to the southern end of the rail line to Darwin. The trucks were driven mostly by African Americans of the US Motor Transport Command, and the round trip could take up to 12 days.
Darling, I ain't going down the long road by myself. And I ain't going down that long road by myself. If I can't take you, I'll sure take somebody else.
From Newcastle Waters northwards, tangled forests of lancewood and impenetrable bullwaddy scrub open onto savannah grassland as the highway pushes ever north. Daly Waters is a good 3-hour drive from the Three Ways. Here, a crucial chapter of Australia's aviation history was written. Not that you could tell nowadays. There's not much left apart from the pub, one of the oldest stone buildings in northern Australia. Bob Ulford is one of the territory's most respected military historians, and I asked Bob about Daly Waters' early days and its role during the war.
Daly Waters was one of the most significant places in the territory, and certainly in Australia, as regards the early aviation history. The first landing strip was cleared around 1927, and Daly Waters actually became a very unlikely international hub in the 1930s, when Qantas, McRoberts and Miller from Western Australia, and of course the Dutch airline KNILM, started flying international routes into northern Australia. And from the very start of World War II, Daly Waters became a strategic staging point or transit airfield for Allied aircraft heading north to Singapore, and certainly to the combat in Java in early 1942. It was an important staging post on what they called the Brereton route from the eastern states. The American B-17s operated there in 1942. Australian Hudson bombers, the Wirraways flew through there, and of course the Kitty Hawks of the American Air Force, and later Spitfires, Bowfighters, and a range of aircraft all used it as a staging point.
Journey's end for all the convoys was Larimer, a word meaning meeting place in the local Aboriginal language. It was here that convoy passengers boarded converted cattle trucks for their onward passage to Darwin. Alex Rigby was a soldier with the Darwin Infantry Battalion and one of those passengers.
For the 316 miles, it could take 3 days. Main reason is the troop trains were too long and the engine couldn't pull this train and its load over some of the rises in the track. So the driver would then, or the guard, would unhook half the train, leave it there, take the forward half forward to the next siding, unhook it, come back and pick up the second half and then proceed. Hours, literally wasted. Also, the engine on more than one occasion, would run out of coal. So the whole of the troops on board the train would scavenge across the paddocks, literally, picking up firewood to keep the boiler going.
The tropical top end, land of palms and cycads, of stringy barks and tall speargrass, a land of the senses, of intense humidity, heat, and electric storms. To the men and women who served in Australia's north, it was as alien to them as any foreign field. Katherine, the largest town on the highway between Alice and Darwin, marks the southernmost point of Japanese raids during the war. It was attacked once in the early afternoon of March the 22nd, 1942. Dorothy Hall witnessed the attack.
First of all, we didn't know which ones they were. They were flying in quite a big formation of bombers. And then someone called out their Japs, and we all ran down the rail, down the bank of the Katherine River. And they had a look at Katherine, particularly the aerodrome area, and then they flew back, and it appears that they looked along the Edith River. So apparently they knew they had to come to some river. Well, then they came back. And we had, in the meantime, came up to eat our lunch. We didn't know who they were and we thought they'd gone. Well, then they came over and began to drop their bombs. And we were out garping, of course, like everybody else. And Noel pulled me behind a big Moreton Bay fig tree and pressed me to the trunk. And he had his hands round like that. And he got his hands cut with stuff out of a daisy cutter, a type of bomb they used to use, filled with all sorts of bottle tops and lumps of glass and all that sort of thing. The old lady who kept the store, Mrs. McKinnon, she had a petrol sign outside, and she tottered out to pick up a petrol sign, and the blast of a daisy cutter that was dropped close to the old Katherine store blew her right across her bedroom, which had a cement floor, and so she was rather knocked about. There was one native killed, Roger, who ran into a pile of rocks. Well, the bombs were dropped right down the aerodrome. They dropped them straight along the aerodrome, and then they dropped some out towards Mambaloo.
You're listening to The Road to War on ABC Radio National's Hindsight, the remarkable story of the Stuart Highway in Australia's Northern Territory during World War II, and the men and women who journeyed along that road. North of Pine Creek, MacDonald Airfield was home to 18 Netherlands East Indies RAAF Squadron, with its unique mix of personnel, Australian, Dutch and Javanese. Ted Lewis was a driver at MacDonald and remembers a tragic crash on takeoff.
My instructions were to be on the strip at 6 a.m. with the fire crew. Three planes were to take off and you'll be advised on the time of return. I heard the first plane take off. Then the second plane took off. Well, I just started off when there was the most unholy crash, a blinding flash of light, and a bomb exploded. I kept on going and got out to the end of the strip, which was the south end, and had the whole of the strip in front of me. The planes had been taken off from a south to a north direction. And we knew the plane had gone in, but couldn't make up our mind what we might do. And we were about halfway down the strip when another bomb went off. Well, this was pretty frightening because there was this huge flash of light and then the roar of the bomb, and it sounded as though it was just a couple of hundred yards from the end of the strip. Well, when we got to the end of the strip, we were only able to proceed into the into the bush for only perhaps 100 yards when it got that thick that we couldn't go any further. Well, by this time it was, I would say, about half light. Well, the time we got back into the camp, parties had gone out to see if they could find the site of the crash. Flight Sergeant Quinlan told me to take a 4B4, pick up Dr. Storm, who was the Dutch doctor of the squadron, and take him out to the crash. As I pulled up, a stretcher carrying a crew member was being taken to the ambulance. He was still alive, and Dr. Storm examined him for a moment, then turned away shaking his head. The crewman was shockingly injured and burnt, and died later that morning. He was one of the nine that were killed in the crash, of course. I had the sad task of taking seven other bodies back to the squadron. Next morning I took a party of about 16 of the Javanese soldiers to the Adelaide River Cemetery to dig the nine graves that were required. The officer in charge was speaking to the Dutchman in Dutch, the Javanese in Malay, and to me in English. But everything got completed in time, and with the arrival of the funeral party, the burial took place with full military honours.
Fenton Airfield, off the highway 60 kilometres north of Macdonald, was a piece of America planted in the vast northern Australian outback. In 1943 and 1944, Fenton was a major offensive base for long-range bombing missions against Japanese positions in the Netherlands East Indies, New Guinea, and as far as Borneo in the west. Home to B-24 Liberator bombers of the United States Army Air Force and later the RAAF, Australian ground forces were also stationed to defend and support the airfield. Len Rayner was based at Fenton in 1943.
Our fellows were to work on these strips, and they, if there's any damage done, well, they were sent down straight away to fix it up, of course, and they did all the maintenance to the strips. I was in charge, of course, when the raids went off, to make sure that the men were in their trenches. Aeroplanes would take off in the morning about 6 o'clock and arrive back round about that time the next morning. And this was going on and on and on.
They were very young men, these flyers who were flying out of Fenton. Oh, yes. Most of the time. What kind of men were they?
Oh, well, I didn't have very much to do with the aircraft, but to me they were very nice fellows, and they were very young, of course, anything from, I would say, 18 to about 22. On two occasions, we were notified that there was a couple who didn't come back.
What would you do of an evening? Was there beer there? Could you get a glass of beer?
We spent most of our time playing two-up. We also had up to two bottles of beer were allotted to us, and we enjoyed that. But since we're with the Americans, it was more free, and we'd get about a bottle a day. Of course, while I was there also, John Wayne came over and paid them a visit, and I was lucky enough to be in the sergeant's mess, and my friends invited me over there, and I was introduced to John Wayne. And that was something I thought anyway those days.
He was a famous trumpet man from our Chicago way. He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was the top man at his craft. But then his number came up and he was gone with the draft. He's in the army now, a blowin' reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B.
The small settlement of Adelaide River, 140 kilometres south of Darwin, became a crucial location to fighting the war in the Top End. This quiet roadside township was transformed into a major centre for communications, a supply base and field hospital. Nurse Letty Cudahy served with the Australian General Hospital at Adelaide River in 1942.
We were treating every type of case, surgical, skins, medical, anything. We had 8 or 9 very badly burnt cases came in together. Unfortunately, 2 of those died. An ammunition dump exploded and they were all very badly burnt, mainly in the back from running away from it. Most of the men worked in just shorts, so they had no protection, and just boots, and boots were burnt off their feet. That was a very, very busy time for us. We worked sometimes from 7 in the morning till 10 at night.
A nurse with the AGH had precious little time for rest and relaxation, but there were opportunities to socialise, mostly with servicemen from nearby American units.
We were supposed to be in by 10:30 at night, and if we went out, we had to go and get a leave pass and then bring it back. And if some of the units or some of the RAF squadrons wanted to invite us up officially, they'd send an invitation to the matron, who'd put it on the board, and then we'd put our names down. And she'd notify them of how many were going, 10 or whatever was available and wanted to go. And then they'd send down a buggy or some transport and an officer. And then when we got back complete with the leave pass, I used to have to go to the matron's quarters, which were separate from ours. And she'd be sitting up in bed reading a book, and you'd have to present her with the leave pass and give her the night's activities censored. And then you'd say goodnight and trot off. But a lot of us, including myself, when we were going out privately, didn't altogether worry about leave passes. We used to go out, the sentry, boys on sentry duty at the guard box, they were very blind. And we'd go out and say goodnight, and they'd say goodnight, a little grin on their face. And then we'd go out with our escorts, and when we'd come back, we'd get them to stop a good way before the guard box. And then we'd go through the bush. And at that stage, there were enormous goannas running around the bush, and then we'd sneak in the back way and sneak into their quarters.
It's not the pale moon that excites me, and thrills and delights me, oh no. It's just the nearness of you. It isn't your sweet conversation.
It was here at Adelaide River that a military cemetery was created, and I'm at that cemetery on a bright July morning, where my visit has coincided with that of a large group of veterans from the Airfield Construction Squadron, men who built and maintained the wartime airstrips here in the Top End.
Now, before we go on, Norm was a flying officer, works officer, with number 1 ACS. Ooh. Carry on.
They shall grow not old, as we who are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun, and in the morning, we will remember them.
We will remember them.
Adelaide River is the last resting place for 434 service personnel and 63 civilians. Walking along the lines of gravestones is a moving reminder of the ultimate sacrifice made by so many in the defence of Australia in World War II. Private C.H.R. Bond, 8th Infantry Battalion, 12th of December 1942, aged 23. Sister
Marion W. Younson, 121 Australian General Hospital, 8th of December 1942, age 26. Flying Officer N.C. Brown, Royal Air Force, 1st of July 1944, age 21. Leading Aircraftman W.A. Strang, RAAF, 20th of June 1945, age 21. And here, R.H. Stobbo, Deck Cadet, Australian Merchant Navy, killed on the 19th of February 1942 in those first raids on Darwin, age 16. And here in the civilian section, the graves of the Darwin Post Office staff, killed early on that day on February the 19th. Hertel Bald, the postmaster, and his wife Alice, and their daughter Iris, who was only 16. Jean and Eileen Mullen, Archibald Halls, Emily Young, Arthur Wellington, and Jenny Stasinovsky. As the highway approaches the outer reaches of Darwin, traces of the territory at war become ever more frequent. From Kumali northwards, one can still see glimpses of the huge infrastructure put in place to defend the top end and to begin to turn the tide of war back to the enemy. Richard Laxton is a farmer, historian, and passionate conservationist of heritage landmarks. He also owns a wartime airstrip at Kumali, just off the highway, 30 kilometres north of Adelaide River.
Well, I guess as a kid growing up in Sydney, I was always interested in Australian history and came up to the territory in 69, moved into the rural area and reckon it was a great place to be and felt there was a future in farming. And a couple of years after the cyclone, I wanted to get a block bigger than the 10 acres that I had, and all I could find was 13,000 acres down on Kumali Creek, so that's where it all started for me. The property is probably unique that it's got not only the airstrip but the taxiways and the revetments that they parked the aircraft in. It's got the camps from the two squadrons that were based there during the war, along with anti-aircraft gun emplacements and an army battalion campsite, all on the one property. Kumali airstrip itself came online at the end of 1942. Kumali was built originally for 31 Squadron Bowfighter, and at last Australian Air Force squadrons were getting modern and effective aircraft that could compete seriously with anything that the enemy had. The Bristol Bowfighter was the first low-level attack aircraft with a long range. Their party trick was to come in just before sunrise, hit the enemy at low level before they had a chance to get out of bed or even get up an aircraft to start keeping a watch. Their most effective raid was over at Penfui, which is now Kupang, and they took out something like 19 enemy aircraft on the ground in a 10-minute attack. Casualties, unfortunately, were there. There are quite a few aircrew from Bowfighter squadrons whose last resting place has never been found. They were shot down over enemy territory or crashed into the sea. It's quite amazing, even today, when people come up to visit the top end, to find that they just weren't aware that Australia was physically attacked. And when they hear that it was attacked something like 64 times, and each of those raids may have in fact attacked several sites. So the number of times that an enemy hit specific targets on the top end of Australia runs into hundreds. And all of this went on from starting February 1942, and they were still going on till November 1943, and there are reports from individual units of attacks by the Japanese even after the last official raid. From oral history from some of the chaps who were here, they can clearly document that there was in fact a raid late in 1943 by the Japanese on Kamali, so it probably has the distinction of being the last place on Australian soil to be attacked by an enemy.
I've seen a wonderful photograph that relates to Kamali that's in your possession. Can you tell me about that photograph?
Well, at the end of the war, Photo Reconnaissance Squadron was still based at Kamali. They had a very long-range aircraft, and that was the de Havilland Mosquito, the mighty wooden wonder that was powered by two Rolls-Royce engines. And on the day that the war ended, in August 1945, the Photo Reconnaissance Mosquito had taken off, headed out over the Timor Sea. He was radioed through to say that the war had ended, returned to base immediately. The aircraft came back about an hour later, and to celebrate the end of the war, a lot of the squadron members were down on the airstrip, and the aircraft did a magnificent low pass at about 40 foot up the strip. The guys were there in this photograph of the aircraft thundering overhead, and they're standing there punching the air. It's a really dynamic photo that shows through the jubilation that they had. The war was over at last.
You're listening to The Road to War on ABC Radio National's Hindsight, the story of a road that was the lifeline for defending Australia in World War II, and the men and women who witnessed war at home. A couple of kilometres north of Kumali, a turnoff takes you to Batchelor, another major airfield used by the Americans and the RAAF throughout the war. Corporal Ralph Boyce was based at Batchelor in 1942. He was one of the ground crew for the 49th Pursuit Fighter Group, the American squadron equipped with P-40 Kitty Hawks, and the aircraft that would first intercept the enemy over the top end.
The past two nights have given us our first taste of night raids. A bright new moon has lit up the country like day. The Nips have taken advantage of it to bomb the section two nights in a row. They met no opposition from the air, as our boys are not allowed to take off at night. They are straining at the leash, though, and would give anything to be allowed to go up for a crack at them. Last night, the Nips reached past the 34-mile strip, over halfway down the road to here at Batchelor, and were so close we could see the flash of the AK-AK in the air. Perhaps tonight they'll find this field.
The strip the American pilots flew from still remains. A plaque close by commemorates the arrival at Batchelor of General Douglas MacArthur en route to Melbourne on the 17th of March 1942, after his evacuation from the Philippines, the journey upon which he would utter those famous words, "I shall return." In January 1942, around 13,000 personnel were camped along the northern section of the highway. With the fear of imminent invasion after the first raids on Darwin, this figure is estimated to have grown to some 100,000 by the beginning of 1943. Jim Gayton was a leading hand carpenter with the Allied Works Council, responsible for constructing many of the camps along the road.
And most of our camps were just bush piles in the ground, bush collar tie, bush rafter, and bush purlins, and all tied together with wire, because nails are not much use in bush piles. The kitchens, we generally finished up fly wiring the actual kitchens, but not the messes. Later on, those things came about. They came about later on camps like Gorry. But a lot of our material that we used was rescued from Darwin. We would send one or two trucks a week up to Darwin to bring back scraps, corrugated iron, and that would be sorted out. The best of it would go onto the roofs, the not so good around the walls, and the actual rubbish would go into the revetment bay, the blast walls around the revetment bays. The civilian personnel side has never been truly presented, I feel. You know, whilst there were not a lot of us here, there were people here who were really dedicated to their country just as much as the service personnel were.
The roadside airstrips are perhaps the most recognisable and evocative symbols of the war fought in the Top End. These runways, carved out of the tropical bush, are still here. I'm walking beside the highway at Strauss, the most intact of the strips. It remains a tangible reminder of the exploits and courage of the American, British and Australian fighter pilots who fought the air war in the skies above. Alongside me is veteran Sid James. Sid, you were with the airfield construction squadron maintaining this strip in late 1942. Tell me about your time here.
We used to do work all day and then do 4 hours guard at night.
And where would your camp have been here?
About halfway along the strip on that side.
On the other side of the road.
It was all bush right to the road. There was Kitty Hawks, P-40s when I was here, not Spitfires.
And during this time, can you remember any raids on the strip?
Oh, quite well. They liked moonlight nights because the strip would show up in the moonlight. I was there for the only two raids in Strauss, the 26th and the 27th of November, 42. Well, we were sitting in our tent and the siren went and the pilot said, oh, we're going to have a raid. I said, well, it sounds like it or whatever. And so we went and got in a trench about less from the middle of that bush. Sat on the side of the trench and I was looking north because I was on the southern side. But before the Japs dropped any bombs, three flares went up to show the Japs where to bomb. And then the swishing, you could hear the bombs coming down. And it was fortunate in a way that they missed the strip, but most of the bombs went down through the camp area. As far as I can remember, there was no casualties. Well, next morning, they got a black tracker to come and to see if he could find out where the spy went, to whoever it, well, it would have to be a spy to do such an atrocious thing. Then they tracked him to the railway line and then he had walked along the top of the rail. Well, we were told later that there had been a Japanese reporter. I understand he was a reporter, had been many, many, many years in Darwin, and they had trusted him reasonably well to be in favour of the Australians, like he'd lived here for so long. But after that raid, he disappeared.
Lieutenant Clyde Barnett, a pilot with the US Army Air Force at Strauss, kept a diary. He made this entry in April 1942.
At about 1:30, we got word to stand by that there might be something doing.
My throat went dry as a bone and I couldn't swallow. At the time, my stomach heaved and I could taste sour bile in my mouth. All this time I was running to my plane, getting in, starting up. I taxied out. It was not until I was at 5,000 feet that I settled down. I was stretching my neck, trying to look in all directions at once, when I heard Moorhead's voice calling his flight, very calm and distinct, just like in practice. Enemy bombers, 3 o'clock high. Pretty soon we were closing, and above and behind him, passing over to the right side, into the sun, I noticed there were several stragglers, and one had a long stream of white smoke trailing back. As I watched, his right wing burst into flame, crumpled off, and he went into a flaming spin and crashed into the ocean. The flame was beautiful, rich red-orange. The smoke was black. By this time, we were on the right side of the formation, and about 2,000 feet above them, we started edging in towards the bombers. I went into my dive and started firing from a pretty good way back. I had to pull in behind them, and I swept the whole fuselage from tail to nose and across the right engine. I pulled away and watched him burn and crash into the sea. I heard a thud, 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 and imagine I felt the plane jump. I pushed the nose down, and I looked over my shoulder, and I saw a Zero about 700 or 800 feet back, right on my tail. I headed straight down and was almost immediately in a 500-mile-per-hour vertical dive. I held it there for a few seconds, glanced around, and started easing out. I landed with about 15 gallons of gas. When I got out, I found 3 small caliber bullet holes in my plane, one in each wing and one in the left elevator. The final score for the 8th that day was 8 bombers and 3 zeros. There was some real excitement around there that afternoon. They brought us some sandwiches and iced tea, and I realized how much I needed it.
Darwin, the northern tropical capital, still holds the indelible marks of its wartime history. The relics and abandoned sites remain, a silent testament to those who were here those years ago.
But I can't go!
In 1943, Cliff Taylor was a sergeant with an anti-aircraft battery positioned not far from the highway.
Our living conditions were primitive. Low tin huts built next to the guns. The doorways were only 5 feet 6 inches high and the huts had dirt floors. The heat and humidity was unbearable. We used cake tins filled with smouldering rags to ward off the mozzies. The worst gut-wrenching fear was when the bombers came straight at us in a direct line and released their bombs from the danger release zone. The people watching through binoculars and instrument telescopes would murmur, "Bombs away!" and a dreadful 20 seconds would follow until the bombs landed. Then a sigh of relief. Night raids were frightening. Huge gun flashes, flares dropping, everything seemed unreal. It took some time for the eyes to lose that yellow haze. The Japs seemed to drop their bombs anywhere, and stayed over Darwin for a longer time than usual when raiding at night. The invasion scare was at its height, and we had to keep our rifles, ammunition, and emergency rations with us at all times. One morning, about dawn, we got the invasion alarm. Everyone was saying, "It's on!" I remember my hands were shaking as I unrolled the maps in the command post and we readied the artillery ammo. It was a false alarm. In one raid, 30-odd Betty bombers and the same number of fighters met the wing of Spitfires, about 130 planes altogether. They clashed right overhead. from about 25,000 feet down to almost ground level, with some of the Spits going straight at the bombers. Planes wheeling, milling, machine guns, cannon fire, planes on fire, pilots bailing out, men dying. It's hard to imagine that this happened in Australia.
Of course, traffic on the wartime highway wasn't only travelling north. The road carried thousands of evacuees south from Darwin. It witnessed the infamous exodus of many service personnel and panic-stricken civilians after the first attacks. And in the days and weeks that followed, when shipping lanes were closed and the threat of invasion was at its height, the remaining civilians, refugees in their own country. Driving into town today, the past is all around, if you have time to look. The RAAF base is on the right, bombed regularly between 1942 and 1943. Its original Art Deco gatehouse, glimpsed through tall coconut palms, is now largely forgotten and ignored, standing beside the unremarkable security gate of today's base. A kilometre further on is the turnoff to Ross Smith Avenue. This road was the original runway of the civil aerodrome, which was used extensively by the military during the war, and which came under attack many times. Beyond that is the Fanny Bay anti-aircraft site, from where Cliff Taylor looked out as the bombs dropped. On towards the CBD, and the last few hundred metres of this historic road. It's here, as it becomes Daly Street, that the highway ends. To the left, the Esplanade, and in front, beyond the lawns of Bicentennial Park and below, are the waters of Darwin Harbour. The highway finishes here, perched above the port that it was built to sustain, and the place that witnessed the first ever attack by an enemy on Australian soil. Today, the calm waters below hide the remains of the ship sunk and many of those who perished with them on February the 19th, 1942. It's a location that forever symbolises Australia at war, alongside Gallipoli, Kokoda, Long Tan and other foreign fields. But this story was about a war here at home, and a road runs through that story.
The Road to War was produced and presented by Mike Sweet, with the assistance of ABC Radio's Regional Production Fund. Technical production was by Russell Stapleton. The archive interviews heard in the program were provided courtesy of the Northern Territory Archives Service, the Bob Alford Collection, and the Centenary of Federation, NT. The readings were by Sean Kavanagh, Dennis Schultz, and Joris Wilson. You can download an MP3 file of the program at abc.net.au/rn and go to Hindsight, where you might also want to add your memories of the war in our guest book. Next week, we're taking a journey into the Burragurang Valley before it was flooded in the 1950s to create Sydney's major water supply, the Warragamba Dam. Thanks to the drought, the dam's now at around 40% capacity, and some of the foundations and fence lines of the old homesteads have been left exposed. Former residents who were forced to vacate the valley when the Sydney Water Board resumed their properties have, for the first time, been able to visit the land on which their childhood homes stood. It's become a place suspended in time, in the memories of those who lived there. And the week after on Hindsight, we'll hear tales about the building of Warragamba Dam. I'm Claudia Taranto. See you then. Thank you.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.